This is the current federal tax developments for the week of December 7th, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, recording this week here in Phoenix as we go for our first recording for the week of December, the last week of 2020. We're going to start talking about what happened this week in various tax issues. Now, this week was kind of a quiet week. Not a whole lot went on this week. In fact, what we had were just a very few issues took place, and most of them are not really major issues, shall we say, but they're just more news from the IRS and various other issues because it was a week after Thanksgiving. So a lot of, shall we say, heavy hitter projects had come out before or are awaiting action later, so it wasn't the sort of thing they picked up this week. First thing we'll talk about is we'll be looking at the fact that the IRS announced that multi-factor authentication is going to be available for all online tax products this season, although I think most professionals probably saw it last year in their tax product. We also have the IRS giving some relief for issues that may arise if you are a company using a van pool for commuter highway vehicles and you discovered that the COVID-19 pandemic caused you to fail to be able to meet the amount of use of the vehicle that was expected in order to qualify it for that use. The IRS also announced this week that they will be expanding the opt-in IP PIN program nationwide, something that Congress had told them they would have to do in a couple of years when they passed the Taxpayers First Act a year ago. Actually, it was in July of 2019. The IRS is going to go forward with this at this time. We'll discuss what in the world that may mean. And finally, we'll talk about a case that on remand, the district court in this case changed its decision regarding whether the taxpayer had willfully failed to report their Swiss bank account on their FBAR. And the change of decision now, after the Third Circuit kicked it back, ended up costing the taxpayer nearly $1 million in additional penalties. So let's start out now with the multi-factor authentication issue that I discussed earlier. This was the IRS's National Tax Security Awareness Week, and there were a number of announcements by the IRS this week. We'll talk about two of them related to various security issues with tax, basically to involve both tax pros and taxpayers themselves. Now, this one the IRS is discussing in this case, this was the 2021 online tax preparation products to offer multi-factor authentication for taxpayers, tax pros. This was news release IRS 2020-266. It was issued on December 1st. What the IRS is discussing here is an agreement between the IRS, the state tax agencies, and the various tax software providers that the providers will offer a multi-factor authentication option for logging in for all of their online tax programs for the 2020 tax season. Now, for those of you who are not aware as to what MFA multi-factor authentication is, and I suspect most of you are aware because your software began requiring it, but that is where when you go to log in to the site, whether it is to send up your electronic returns to the IRS, whether it is to use an online hosted service with your tax program, or whatever it might be, in addition to providing your username and password, the normal two things we've always had to provide, there is a third piece of information you must provide. Generally, it is a code, and this code may be provided to you in a number of different ways. Generally, the way it's provided is either through use of an authenticator app. The authenticator app, when you set up your account, generally you are shown what will be some sort of QR code on the screen. You will scan that with your phone. That will enable your phone to every 30 seconds or so, or 60 seconds or so, to generate a new six-digit number that you must provide. And the theory of how that works is the server on the other end has a copy of the same seed, and that seed will always produce the same six-digit number based on the time of day. And the idea is that you know the seed, the server knows the seed, and each end computes the proper six-digit number based on when you provide it. Alternatively, we will see some systems use the option of having that six-digit code sent to you via text message. It could also be sent to you via email. So the IRS is discussing those options. And in fact, they actually, when they give their example, they actually discuss the sending a numerical code to the mobile phone. Now, there's an unfortunate side effect here when you send a code to a mobile phone that the IRS even acknowledges. They start at the top and they list that as an example, but toward the end when they're describing MFA, they do indicate that the authenticator apps are far more secure. And I guess it's relative. They are far more secure. That doesn't mean that the others are wildly insecure, but here's your problem. The one problem you have whenever you use something that involves a transmission of a code back to you, where the machine on one end generates a code, the server generates a code, and that code comes back over to you via a transmission, let's say text message or via email, that code is always has the possibility of being intercepted. And whether that code goes via email or SMS text message, the problem is that the messages are essentially are going to be a problem because they're going to go over systems, either email or SMS messaging, that was not initially designed to be secure. So there is a possibility, admittedly it's not likely, but still possible, the code could be intercepted. Even worse, if somebody was really wanted a one-time, you know, hit-and-run technique against you, they could, if they thought you were high value enough, use what's called simjacking if you are getting codes via text message. What simjacking involves is that they find out your cell phone number, whatever mechanism they use to discover that. You may actually have that on your website if clients call it. And then they go down to your carrier and they give a basic sob story about how they have, for whatever reason, lost the phone. This is like the second or third one you've lost, and your spouse is going to kill you, and you need to get a new phone without them knowing it. And then when they start asking for the ID stuff, like your PIN and stuff you're supposed to provide, you, of course, get all flustered and get very up, you know, get very, very much worried. And so you get them sympathetic with you, and they issue you, for whatever reason, a SIM. Also could simply be by bribing the online employee, by Mr. Employee, but let's assume that they're not going to be dishonest at that end. And once you put that SIM in another phone, essentially that begins receiving the messages. Your phone shuts down. Now it is a hit and run technique because eventually you'll figure out that your phone doesn't work anymore. And eventually you'll go back in and find out, oh, a new SIM was issued, and voila, you'll get it fixed. So that's why it's usually for a rapid hit. But that's why we prefer, if you can, to be using those apps. Just going to let you warn about why that is. It's not that it's likely you'll be hit by that, but it's like the app, it doesn't have any risk of that because, again, as I said, there's nothing being transmitted. There's no real way to intercept the two. There is a secret the server knows or is a secret you know. And while theoretically, I guess, somebody could get the secret from the server, it's like, well, if they get in the server that far, why don't they just go get the data on the server? So we'll go ahead and we'll assume that basically those are going to be your better choices. But in any event, we'll go on now after the service tells us one way and then says, well, that's probably not the best way to do it. This is being expanded this year to all online products. Now, the IRS did note that the vendors did not provide, while they agree to offer multi-factor authentication, they don't say that you have to use it in all cases. That said, most professional software, I believe, now has swapped over to mandating MFA, and in fact, many of them did last year, if not for all uses, for at least ones that are considered especially sensitive, like electronically filing the return. And so we've been using that for a while. If not, they do now strongly recommend that you turn it on. Why should it be used? The problem with passwords are that they are normally have some serious problems. Many people with passwords do one of various things, all of which cause us issues. They either use a very simple password that is that falls to a dictionary attack, or can be easily guessed, or what they do is they use the same password on every site. The problem with that is if some site gets, basically they lose control of their passwords, and sites that you may very well have had an account on at some point, have included LinkedIn and have included Adobe. you know, all of the Adobe sites. We had issues in both where they lost control and either it was a plain text password or there was real question about the security of how the passwords had been stored on the website that suggested somebody could figure out what they were. And the problem with that is once they figure it out, they'll then try that password. And of course, if you've been using that password on the site you're doing your tax with, well, yeah, we have a problem. Then there's also just the general simple rule of a phishing attack that goes after you to grab the password by making you think you are on Thomson Reuters' site or CCH's site or Intuit's site when you're actually not on those sites, and by getting your username and password from there, then they could log in later and do what they wish. The idea being with MFA, having your username and password does them no good unless they can also produce the code, and we're going to hopefully have controlled the code in such a way that it won't come back to them, and therefore you'll be able to be the only one to be logged in. Now, like we said, the various options here, we mentioned why the apps are the best. Again, if your software has MFA and it doesn't require it, which would be unusual at this point, you should go look and turn it on and force all staff members to use it. Secondly, if you have a choice with any MFA, you should be using the app to the authenticator option if available. Sometimes the authenticator options are a bit quirky. For instance, if you use Thomson Reuters products, they'll tell you to go get the Thomson Reuters Authenticator app. In reality, that uses the standard authenticator method backdoor, but they also can send a message to your phone about this issue and let you click a box and it'll transmit over for, you know, knowing the link up with your phone for your account. So they can do that as well. And what it is, they will get the phone to send the code back over. And that will be, of course, the proper code. So they have ways of handling that sort of system. Again, the authenticator mechanism was developed by Google a number of years ago. So the best known authenticator app is Google's Authenticator. However, it is an open standard. There are many non-Google authenticator apps out there now for various reasons. You can use them. Even using Google's is not truly, I know a lot of people freak out about information that may be transmitted, but in this case, everything stays on the phone. So because the code's there, it is a security issue only. And as I said, we can use this without risking. Certainly, if you have the choice, I do strongly, strongly recommend use the app-based system. Next up, we're going to go to some IRS relief due to COVID again. We haven't had a good COVID relief development in a while, so we're going to get a new one this time. The IRS ad frequently asked questions about COVID relief for van pools. This is on the IRS website on December 3rd of 2020. Now, what this relates to is a benefit you can offer your employees called giving them transportation, from transporting them to the office using what's called is a commuter highway vehicle. Now, what a commuter highway vehicle is you have, generally it's going to be a van, and at least 50%, it has to be at least 6 seats, and at least 50% of the adult seating capacity must be, essentially used for transporting on an average basis employees to work. And we also have to have that 80% of the mileage, is going to be in this, right? Where we're going to have 80% of our mileage, we'll be transporting employees in our 6-person or greater van where half or more of the seats are being used by employees. Now, due to COVID-19, you may very well have discovered that your employees were working from home quite a bit. There were many, many fewer who were being transported to the office. And therefore, even though you may have had to send your vans out to the various locations where your employees may live, you're discovering that they're not filling it up and meeting the 80-50 rule. And that creates a concern because now the problem is, generally, this particular benefit is one where the employees don't have to recognize the value of that transportation you're providing them. But if you can't meet these requirements, then in theory, you would need to put the value of that into everybody's W-2 when your vehicles do not meet these requirements. As we said, due to COVID-19, generally, we may have had a little more trouble meeting those requirements. Well, what the IRS has decided, and actually the law says this too, If you reasonably expected to use at least 80% of the mileage for the year would be used to transport the employees from their residences to their place of employment, and the number of employees transported be at least 50% of the adult seating capacity of the vehicle, but due to COVID-19 emergency, you didn't meet those requirements because fewer employees had to be transported, it will nevertheless still be considered to be a commuter highway vehicle, and you will continue to meet those requirements this year. Now, I should say the law has always said if you reasonably believed it was going to meet those requirements, you'd be fine. So in one sense, it's not surprising the service went this way, but it is something to know that this is how this is run. So as we said, if you've got this, we'll be able to simplify and just not worry about this. Probably this was mainly of interest in areas like the Silicon Valley, where this is probably much more often used, but we will go ahead and keep aware of that. The next development here is another one from the IRS's National Security Tax Awareness Week. This was an announcement where the IRS expanded the ID Identity Protection PIN opt-in program to taxpayers around the nation. This is IRS News Release IR-2020-267. This was issued on December the 2nd, 2020. Now, this relates to the IRS's IP PIN program. And what we're going to do is allow taxpayers across the country beginning in January to opt into the program. Now, if you've been around for a while, you know that where this started was when we first started seeing tax-related identity theft. The IRS began allowing or basically issuing to taxpayers these things called IP PINs. And the idea was if your taxpayer had been subjected to tax-related identity theft and you really didn't want to have that continue happening, what they would do is they would issue that PIN, IP PIN, to the taxpayer. The IP PIN would basically be to help assure, in addition to their Social Security number and their name and address, they would need to provide this PIN. The thieves that were looking to steal, you know, to grab refunds, would not have the PIN, would be unable to file the return. Now, after they started that program, what the IRS did was they essentially expanded it out first to a few states that had a high level of IP of tax-related identity theft take place. And then over the years since then, they have done a bit of expansion. Now, when they passed the Taxpayer First Act in 2019, Congress basically put the IRS on a deadline to expand the opt-in version of this program nationwide by 3 years, as I recall, after the date of the passage of the Taxpayer First Act. So the IRS is now going to, slightly early, allow a nationwide version of the opt-in program. Now, the IRS does tell you a few things about this you probably need to know and your clients need to know. First thing is, anybody that wants to do this is going to have to prove that they are actually the taxpayer. As the commissioner is quoted in the news release, clearly, the IRS has to first make sure the people getting the IP PIN are actually the taxpayer in question. This could go very, very wrong if the thief ends up being able to get the IP PIN in the name of the taxpayer. That could turn out pretty bad. So what your taxpayer is going to have to do is either be able to end up going through the IRS's Secure Access Program. And they have a website that they suggest you go to find out about what you'll need to provide for secure access. If you've signed up for e-services as a professional, you know the basic things they're going to need. They'll probably need to have a credit card or some other financial account that could verify them. They'll need a cell phone in their name generally. And there'll be some other questions they'll have to answer. And if they do that, the IRS will issue the PIN right away online. If they are unable to use that or cannot pass it for whatever reason, then if they have income of $72,000 or less and they have access to a telephone, they can complete Form 15227 and mail or fax it to the IRS. And then an IRS assister, I love that term, that they give the title to this person, will call the taxpayer to verify their identity with a series of questions and who pass this authentication, they'll get their IP PIN in the mail. Now remember, if you do it online, they will give it to you at the end of the online process. If a taxpayer cannot verify their identities remotely or they're ineligible to use the Form 15227, then they can make an appointment and visit a taxpayer assistance center, bring two forms of picture identification, and again, at the end of this thing, they will mail them the IP PIN again. They will not be provided at the location. Now, the IRS also tells people, if you're going to be part of this program, please remember, you only give your IP PIN to a trusted tax provider. They warn you that the IRS will never call you and ask for this number. They remind taxpayers that they need to be aware and alert for scams looking to get this number from them. Because remember, if an ID thief really wanted to do something with your information or file a return on your behalf, they need this PIN. So obviously, we have to kind of make sure they don't get it. So that's going to be key. Now, the IRS notes a few things you need to know. They say the tool will be up and running in mid-January. It is the preferred method to go online and get it. And the only one that will immediately reveal the PIN, so you can get it right away. And the theory is once you get it, you'll also be able to lock down the account. If you want to voluntarily opt into the IP PIN program, you do not need to file the Identity Theft Affidavit, Form 14039. If you are an actual victim of identity theft, tax identity theft, because you have a return rejected, that is the form you'll still fill out. The IP PIN in this case, if it's a voluntary IP PIN, is valid for 1 year, and a new one apparently will not automatically be sent to you the next year. You'll have to go back online in the next January, log in, and generate a new one again. As they remind you, the IP PIN must be properly entered on any electronic or paper tax return. If you do not do that, you will either have the return rejected or you'll be delayed in processing. You can get an IP PIN if you have either a Social Security or an individual tax identification number, as long as you can verify your identity. And any primary taxpayer, the first on the return, secondary taxpayer, which is the second taxpayer on the return, on a joint return, or a dependent may obtain the IP PIN if they can pass the identifying proofing requirements. And in 2022, they're going to apparently consider rolling out an opt-out feature if the taxpayer finds the plan is not right for them. Now, that's interesting. It will explain that. You know, does that mean, for instance, if I do it in 21, you know, if I do it basically for my 20 return and I don't like it, will I have to go in and either get a new IP PIN or opt out or do an opt out thing? Or is this just going to be that if I opted in January of 2022 and then come April, I decide I don't want to do it, would they give me a way to get out? That's not really clear what they mean by that. So we'll need some clarification there. Now, like they said, they do also clarify for us that it will not impact the process that taxpayers go through who have verified, confirmed tax-related identity theft. They will still be going through the same process they do today. They will still be in the program because of security risks. They're going to get everything mailed out in this case, right? If you're a confirmed victim, you can still use the Get an IP PIN tool to retrieve a lost IP PIN, right? And they and those who are confirmed tax-related identity theft individuals are not going to be able to opt out of the program. So, you know, that is one to be aware of. Finally, this week, we're going to revisit a case we actually talked about 3 years ago because it was sent back to the trial court. This is Bedrosian versus United States, case number 2:15CV05853. It's a case from the Eastern District, United States District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania. The opinion was issued on December 4th, 2020. Now, this involved a taxpayer who had two bank accounts in Switzerland. And there were a lot of interesting facts in the case, but in the original case, the court looked at the facts and decided that based on subjective tests, as the court would phrase it now, they decided that subjectively they believed that the taxpayer had not willfully intended to fail to report the second account, and so they ruled it was not a willful, just negligent failure to put the information on. And the advantage of that was that his penalty, well, for only being negligent, was $9,800, as opposed to what would be a requested $1,007,000 if it was willful. The IRS appealed this decision to the Third Circuit, who kicked it back. And what the Third Circuit said is, no, the test is not whether subjectively it was willful. Rather, they say, you know, was it reckless? So if there's a reckless violation of the FBAR standard, that would be engaging in contact that violates an objective standard. That action entailing an unjustifiably high risk of harm that is either known or so obvious it should have been known. That is, you know, objectively, is it clear that he either knew or should have known that there was a problem with his FBAR reporting and an account was omitted? So it was remanded back to the court to be tested under those terms. And the court, therefore, came back and we had new briefs put in, new information put in, and then the court went back to decide and apply the test that way. And the court found in this case that they agreed with the government that there were some key facts that objectively considered indicated there's a problem here. So, for instance, they said, look, he did not begin to cooperate with the U.S. government in terms of getting this corrected until such time as he was exposed as having hidden his foreign account. So they said, well, that seems to negate, you know, in essence, that cooperation, which the court had found negated willfulness first time. They said, well, okay, we can kind of agree that it probably doesn't count if he was being cooperative, but only after somebody showed up with the guns and the handcuffs. So that's probably a problem. Also, there was a weird thing. One of the claims was he wasn't aware he had two accounts overseas. He thought there was only one. But as they said, shortly after filing that FBAR form that had only the one account, he sent two letters to his Swiss bank directing closure of the two accounts. But only one of them was listed on the FBAR. The second account was moved to a different Swiss bank, and that account did not have the funds brought back in the U.S. Presumably, that looks like he's still trying to hide those funds, which, oh, by the way, that second account was the much larger account of the two. So, okay. He read an article, he also said, didn't dispute, he read an article in the Wall Street Journal that talked about the federal government tracing mails coming into the United States, and was alerted to the possibility of the United States finding out about his foreign bank account if the bank sent him any information about his account through the mail. And just coincidentally, his account was labeled to the bank on a mail hold. And a mail hold means that, you know, the UBS was not going to send him anything through the mail on the account. He did not dispute the fact he had one, or he signed a form and paid the bank for this benefit. And the theory being that, well, why are you doing this? And the main reason was because being aware of the mails, well, there's an implication there that you were doing it to hide the account. And he was aware that there was a significant amount of money held in his foreign accounts, which became key because his FBAR account, that one in 2007, only reported a single account with well under $1 million in it. And it turns out that, well, it was kind of above $1 million in the second account. Also, they noted three things that the court had found in its original opinion that had decided was not enough to show willfulness, but now needs to be added to the top of this was, you know, the inaccurate FBAR form itself that lacked a reference to that account, the fact he may have learned of the existence of the second account at one of his meetings with a representative, which seems reasonable because after that meeting, he suddenly sent a letter asking, he sent a supported by two separate letters to close the account, he said. Don't need to send two letters to send to close two accounts unless you know you've got two accounts. Bill Tuff. He's a relatively sophisticated businessman, and this was the fun one. His former accountant had told him in the mid-1990s that he was breaking the law by not reporting the UBS accounts as income. So the court came back and said, you know, realistically, they looked at a number of cases. They decided his case was closest to the Fourth Circuit's Horowitz case. And said, you know, basically all of these things we're looking at here, very similar between Horowitz and himself, that essentially it appears that given his actions, it would appear using an objective test that the reality is objective evidence in front of us, not taking his testimony, he didn't mean to do it. That, yeah, you know, it looks like he failed. And a real issue they had, which became a big issue with the Fourth Circuit, and now this court does it as well, one of the things he testified to was, well, he didn't know it wasn't on the FBAR form because he didn't really read the return. And what's become very clear, and now this case too says it, you know, just like the Fourth Circuit, taxpayers cannot ignore the return. You know, a taxpayer failing to review the return is reckless conduct in and of itself, and reckless conduct leads to willful failure to file. A taxpayer who signs a return without reading it is responsible for everything on it. And that includes being responsible for the fact that on Schedule B, he made false statements about the FBAR accounts, and also on the FBAR return itself, he signed an FBAR form that only had one account that reported a balance, which he admits was going to be less than he knew was in the account. And his defense was he didn't read the form. Well, the courts are saying now fairly unanimously that saying I didn't read the form is not going to be a valid defense. Clients must review the tax returns, and if they don't review them, they will be held liable. It's not protection to say that, oh, I didn't read that. You know, it came with me from the CPA. I signed it, and everything's great. Clients are held to the standard of reviewing the return. You probably want to make sure that you've reminded your clients every year about their responsibility to review the return for obvious errors. Again, the courts hold them to a responsibility of finding errors that, given their level of sophistication, they should have noticed. For instance, in this case, given his sophistication, given the fact he should have known that there was no reason he should have believed his foreign interest was not taxable to the U.S. You know, that made no sense. So if he had looked at his tax return carefully, he would have noted, in fact, clearly, because he'd been told before he was breaking the law by not reporting it. We have to assume he knew it was there. And then secondly, you know, he knew what was in the accounts in general. If he had looked at the FBAR form itself in any detail, he would have noticed that the balance being reported on the FBAR form was way below what was actually there. Now, some may decide that really, and this is kind of, I think, where the courts go this route, is, you know, the courts are suspecting that in reality, he knew very well he hadn't told them about the big account. And he's just trying to argue, oh, it must be the mistake of the CPA that he didn't notice this. And by the way, one thing to be very careful about, it is not unknown for clients to attempt to throw the preparer under the bus in a case like this. That's another reason to, you know, remind the clients they have to check the return. You know, rather than saying, oh, my preparer made a mistake and I didn't notice it. You know, if you've been told you need to redo it and review it, you've been told that was your responsibility, you know, basically that shuts them off. Because again, if they are hiding millions of dollars in assets, in this case, $1.9 million, so I guess only not quite $2 million, but he's hiding $1.9 million from the federal government, we have to kind of assume that he's willing to break certain laws, and he might not be that concerned about perjury either. So you have to realize that people lie in court, and you know, and they often lie, especially if they don't think they'll be caught, that there's no way to prove they're lying. So of course you want to say that, you know, oh, I didn't look at the return, I didn't know it wasn't there, and you know, that's essentially trying to say that obviously the CPA fouled up. You know, and that's going to be the route they'll go. So, yes, they will throw you under the bus in that case. Just be aware of that. Don't believe that. Talk to anybody who's ever represented CPAs in any situation that's gone south in front of the IRS, and whether it's been either a malpractice claim or, worst case, it's a criminal case where the client tries to throw the CPA under the bus in a criminal prosecution, and they'll tell you that, yes, you get thrown under the bus. So you better be ready for that fact, because if your client's a dirtbag who is going to cheat on the taxes in huge numbers, they really aren't going to be that worried about perjury either. So, yeah, you have to watch for that and be careful. I want to remind you, I've got a couple of classes coming up this week. We are getting closer to the end of the year, so my class dates are becoming fewer and far between. But I do have a couple late this week. On the 10th of December, I'll be doing a four-hour update on the PPP loan forgiveness for the New Hampshire Society of CPAs. And then on the 11th of December, I'll be doing a session for Hawaii. This one will be on accounting, auditing, and tax considerations for the cannabis industry. The following Monday, on the 14th, I will repeat that same session for the Arizona Society of CPAs, also giving a session that day for the Arizona Society on Arizona taxes. The next day, I will do an eight-hour current federal tax development session, which, interestingly enough, will then be rebroadcast the next day by CalCPA on a rebroadcast session. So we're going to hope in one day nothing huge happens. You know, they don't actually pass the COVID-19 relief late on the 15th of December. So hopefully the 16th will still be valid, but that is available on CalCPA's site. There'll be two rebroadcasts that day. They do that often with Cal, where one will start at 6:30. One will start, yes, I think it is at, 6:30 Pacific time. One starts at 8:30 a.m. Pacific time. Obviously, that's set with two different starts to allow the whole country to do it. A lot of state society of CPAs do use the CalCPA program, so you could sign up with them as well for that. Otherwise, it's been a fun week. You can email me, edzollers at currentfulltaxdevelopments.com. My Twitter handle, at edzollers. I also look in on the Connect sites for state societies of CPAs I'm a member of, which includes Arizona, Illinois, Minnesota, New Jersey, and Washington. So if you have any issues or questions there, you can go into their websites. If you're a member of those societies, and I'll try to look and answer if I have something to say, I'll try to give an answer with it. Otherwise, I'll see you back here next week for the developments. We'll see what else comes up. We'll also see if, in fact, you know, we've been promised this COVID relief bill and, you know, maybe the PPP loan program part two and maybe some other tax breaks. We've been promised that program multiple times. We'll see if we actually get it this time. I'm not really believing it till it passes, but they are again talking about it as I'm here today. They're talking about doing something about it. Again, if that happens, we definitely will go over that stuff when it happens. But otherwise, we'll go over whatever else happens here going up to the end of the year. So we'll see you back here next week for current federal tax developments.